Texting the Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're less than a week away from Thanksgiving. Maybe you're planning on doing the bulk of your shopping this weekend. Before we head out with that super long list, our next guest says, hang on, there's a better way. Do you really want to spend the entire holiday in the kitchen making complicated dishes? Would you rather spend more time with friends and family? Maybe even get to play in this year's Thanksgiving family touch football game. You can, and you don't have to sacrifice the quality of the food either. In this week's edition of Food Friday, we'll find out how to simplify our home-cooked Thanksgiving meal. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think is the most tedious part of cooking for Thanksgiving? Do you have shortcuts you like to use to make the prep and cooking process a little easier? Do you have to have a whole turkey, or can you have smaller amounts of turkey, or maybe something else altogether? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Eric Kim is a cooking writer for the New York Times food section, New York Times cooking, and a columnist for the New York Times magazine. He's the author of the forthcoming cookbook, Korean American Food That Tastes Like Home. Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
I understand you've been cooking Thanksgiving dinner for your family since you were 13. How did that get started?
Yeah, I tell people that and they don't understand. I think it had to do with just being a child of immigrants, and I had parents who didn't cook American food. So, you know, all the kids wanted the things that we were seeing on TV and in our coloring books. So it was really quite easy for all the cousins to just get together and we cooked the meal. And over the years, we just kind of perfected it. And it became a thing that the adults really looked forward to, because it was the one day of the year they got to just like sit back and enjoy the food. Yeah.
If I were in charge at 13, there'd be a whole lot of desserts. Is that what happened for you?
Yeah, absolutely. We definitely prioritize the pies, and my cousin makes a great banana pudding. There was a lot of dessert. Yeah.
Now, for people getting ready for Thanksgiving, it can be a big production. I mean, some people like that, of course. But why do you make the case that we should maybe push the easy button when we can and spend more time with the people we invited over in the first place?
You know, I feel this way about cooking in general. I just think when the stress is taken out of the equation, the food just comes out better. My mom always says not to cook when you're stressed, which is not always the case that you can do that. But on Thanksgiving, you really can just make everything the day before. So many dishes can be reheated the day of. So there's just no reason to do all the cooking the day of. And when you do that, your experience is just so much more fun, and you could enjoy the holiday with your friends and your family.
Yeah. What are the key kind of dishes we can make Wednesday night and know they're going to heat up just fine tomorrow?
Oh, yeah. Gravy for sure. I think people think that you have to make gravy a la minute, but you really don't. I think any cheesy casserole. Stuffing is something that I make ahead of time, and I bake it off the day of. But like mac and cheese, there's so many things that you can make the night before, and then you just have to reheat them in the oven. Potatoes, even salads. Like, people forget to have like a fresh country thing on the table. And with salads, you can do all the vegetable prep before, and you make the vinaigrette, and then you just combine them later. Nothing has to be made a la minute, except for the turkey, maybe. I like turkey the day of.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Eric Kim from the New York Times food section about simplifying Thanksgiving. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you found ways to make great food for the holiday without, you know, just parking yourself in the kitchen all day long while everybody else is having all the fun? Or do you like making that big production? Or you don't want to talk to everybody there, so you want to make the food? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Eric, when I'm in charge of Thanksgiving, I worry that people think I'm the Grinch that stole Thanksgiving, because I don't want to have anything to do with making a whole turkey. And you say that's okay, and you've even got a bone-in turkey breast recipe that comes out great that you shared with us. Can you tell us a little bit about this one?
Yeah, I love a bone-in turkey breast, because at least you have the bone in there. But if you have, you know, a breast, it cooks more evenly, because frankly, a whole turkey, it's so big, it doesn't cook evenly. So the breast dries out before the dark meat is done. So when you have them in parts, whether you like breasts or turkey thighs or turkey legs, I think cooking them separately anyway from the start, just it makes a lot of difference. And you can pull out the breast earlier. I just think it makes a lot of sense for the anatomy of the bird to be cooking them in parts. Yeah.
We've got this recipe posted at WPR.org/foodfriday. It is salt and pepper roast turkey breast. And this brings up another element you're pushing for. There are 5 ingredients in this recipe. You don't want us like worried about this long shopping list when we're coming up with our ideas.
Yeah, for sure. I think in addition to the stress that is caused by the cooking, I really think it's the shopping that can seem really unbearable sometimes. It's like this in regular cooking, but you know, with this turkey breast, especially turkey's so aromatic. It's just, when I was testing this, I had it in my oven and it just perfumed my apartment with turkiness. And turkey has a beautiful kind of gamey, like aromatic flavor. And I just don't think you'd need to do that much to it. I like to like tumble the plate with lemon wedges, and I think it looks really bountiful, and you can squeeze some lemon on your turkey too if you want. But yeah, that's how I do it.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Valerie is with us in Burlington. Valerie, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Valerie?
Well, I wanted to bring up that, you know, like your guest was saying, that a lot of things can be made before, and I really enjoy making the cranberry sauce beforehand, and I found that you can do it about a week ahead of time if you want. I like to grate a little orange zest into my cranberry sauce, and, you know, if you like the more boozy kind of cranberry sauce, like the adult version, you could always put, like, an orange-flavored liqueur or, like, a Grand Marnier that goes along nicely into it. And it stays in the fridge for quite a while. So
I love it. And, Valerie, do you make the turkey day of, or do you make turkey at all?
A turkey day of, definitely. You know, your guest said to make the gravy before. I like to use the drippings from the turkey to make my gravy, but, you know, each to his own.
Valerie, thanks so much. Do you have some thoughts on cranberry sauce, Eric?
Yeah, I do. She's exactly right. Cranberry sauce is the thing that you can make way ahead. It keeps really well in the fridge because there's so much acid and sugar. But my family's favorite cranberry sauce is actually making like a cranberry relish. Usually it'd be with like a whole orange, raw cranberries and sugar, and that's it. But this year I swapped out the orange for a whole lemon, and it's delicious because I love the bitterness of a lemon. And I think some bitterness on the table is really, really refreshing against all the other flavors and kind of cuts through. It's really nice.
Thanks for that call, Valerie. I mean, cranberries are pretty tart and a lemon's pretty tart. It seems pretty pucker-tastic with this recipe. How do you balance that out?
Just the sugar. The sugar does all the work. And another thing, too, is people don't remember that lemon flesh is actually, it's sour, but it's also sweet. Yeah. It's both. So
I can see that. All right. Thanks a lot for calling in, Valerie. Maybe I'll try that sometime. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. This one I liked. Stuffing. People want the stuffing. You've got a recipe. And again, we have this at WPR.org/foodfriday. Cheesy pizza stuffing?
Yeah. It's definitely I'm kind of like having fun with it. Stuffing is my favorite dish, and I love the onion and sage and the regular, you know, traditional stuff. But I really, you know, I tried this one night. It's not as crazy as it sounds. You're blooming tomato paste and dried oregano into butter and onions and threading that through some mozzarella-laden, you know, bread, brioche bread. And this is just like this cheesy, custardy-bound thing that tastes really wonderful. And it tastes like pizza, and that's why I called it cheesy pizza stuffing. It really, if I called it like tomato cheese, you know, stuffing, that would have been another thing too. But I do love stuffing, yeah.
You have one great piece of advice, because I worry, you know, the turkey's going to cook at this temperature and the baked potato dish or whatever at that temperature. You want to streamline things and figure out recipes that can all bake at the same temperature. How do we accomplish that?
Yeah, I think my menu on the New York Times is 7 recipes, nothing cooks at a temperature other than 350 degrees, because I think that's like the perfect temperature for turkey. Like, turkey actually can get crispy over time at that temperature, and if it's a higher temperature, you risk drying it out. And casseroles are great at 350. If you have recipes that call for 375 or 325 or even 400, it really isn't gonna change it too much if you cook it at 350. You just have to watch it and, you know, adjust accordingly. But I really don't think we need to change the temperature of the oven. It just stick to one temperature, whether it's 400 or 350, whatever you prefer. It really will make your life easier. And I just think that gymnastics with the oven is something that's I find really annoying.
It's Food Friday. We're finding out how to have a simpler, easier, but still satisfying Thanksgiving meal. Eric Kim is with us, cooking writer for the New York Times food section and New York Times Cooking. We've got two of his recipes posted at WPR.org/Food Friday. There's the salt and pepper roast turkey breast and cheesy pizza stuffing. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is on your Thanksgiving menu? You getting ready to go shopping in a couple few hours like I am? Are you going to do an entire turkey with all the fixins? Or are you going to try to scale back? Do you feel overwhelmed sometimes if you're cooking that meal for a lot of people? Do you need some advice on how to streamline? And do you do turkey? Do you do turkey breasts? Or do you do something else altogether? I've done that a couple times. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. It's Food Friday. We're talking about Thanksgiving dinner and how to make it simpler so we spend less time in the kitchen on the day of, more time with the people we invited over. Our guest says the key is to cook smarter, not harder. Among his recommendations, do a lot of the stuff on Thanksgiving Eve and take it easy on the ingredients. You can keep things simpler. Eric Kim is a cooking writer for the New York Times food section, author of Korean American Food That Tastes Like Home. That comes out in March. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have some time and or labor saving ideas for your Thanksgiving meals that you want to share, or maybe a story about a Thanksgiving meal gone wrong. I've been there for an oven fire when somebody had trouble with their turkey. Wasn't me. Not that time anyway. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls. Rocky is with us in Niscarro. Rocky, hi.
Hey, how are we doing today?
Good. What do you got for us, Rocky?
Well, son told me about a deal where a deep fat fryer is great for cooking, but we had to do it out in the garage and it was cold. But I bought a deep fat fryer you can do in the house. The one I got will only cook up to a 16-pound turkey, but you can get them bigger. But takes an hour and a half to cook a turkey, and it's nice and juicy and tender and all kinds of good things. So you don't have to worry about setting the oven for the turkey and then adjusting all that stuff.
Rocky, thanks a lot for that. What do you think, Eric, the deep fat fryer for the turkey?
Oh, I'm a huge fan. I think it's delicious, but I live in a tiny shoebox studio in Manhattan, so I don't really have access to that. But I really, if you have access to that, definitely do that. That's delicious.
Thanks a lot for the call, Rocky, at 800-642-1234. We heard from Mark, who couldn't stay with us, but says, hey, if you want to skip the turkey, you can go vegan, and there are lots of yummy vegan dishes that work for Thanksgiving. Do you have any, Eric, ideas for a good entree, a vegan entree for Thanksgiving Day?
I do. The first one that comes to mind is my colleague Lex's. It's a vegetarian mushroom Wellington. Ooh. I just think it's such a, I don't know if it's vegan actually, but it's such a delicious centerpiece. It's really special. And, you know, mushrooms have so much umami. So it's like this savoriness that triggers, like, you know, the glutamate, you know, response on your tongue and makes you think of meat, honestly, and other things like that. But I would recommend that recipe on NYT Cooking. My family loves rice, so if I had a vegan or vegetarian guest, I would probably make a risotto for them, something really special.
Yeah. That sounds good. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Sandy is with us now in Ferryville. Sandy, hi.
Hi. A question. I saw on a cooking show, they removed the backbone of the turkey, and they just spread it out, and they broke the breast bones of one.
Nice.
And then just laid the turkey out and roasted it. And I wondered if that is a good idea or not such a good idea.
Interesting. I've never seen that, Eric. Have you?
Yeah. It's called spatchcocking. It just means removing the back spine. And it's a really great idea because it will make your turkey cook more evenly. One thing is you kind of need good scissors or like kitchen shears, the ones that are like actual poultry shears, because turkeys can be really hard to break through that bone. But otherwise, if you have good scissors, it's a really great way to cook the turkey. It also cooks way faster and more evenly, like I said. So it's a great idea. And also, I would like do the buttermilk brine. Sameen Nasrat on our NYT Cooking app has this wonderful buttermilk rind spatchcock turkey recipe, and it's really great. Yeah,
Sandy, thanks.
I think it's great.
Good luck with that, Sandy. Let us know how it goes. You mentioned the B word there, Eric, brining. And I know I don't care that much one way or the other. Some people really feel passionately pro or con on brining. What are your thoughts?
Oh, yeah. I think if you have the organization and the wherewithal to do that, like the day or two in advance, I would. Because it really, it's insurance, not just against dryness, but also against blandness. With that said, for me, realistically, I know that I'm getting my turkey maybe a day or two before. And that sounds ironic because I'm like, I just wrote about turkey. But I've never organized enough to really, my turkey's always frozen, honestly, the morning of Thanksgiving. So I'm usually doing it a la minute. But my recipe for the salt and pepper roast turkey breast, it actually calls for letting it come to room temperature with like butter and salt on it. And it's not a dry brine, but it's like enough time for the seasoning to kind of penetrate. And it's sort of, I think if you have the time and you're organized, you should.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Linda now in Milwaukee. Linda, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Linda?
Well, I have a small, time I have to do my turkey. I don't do turkey anymore. I do a roast chicken. But I'm wondering, I use a clay pot that I found out is just wonderful. You put your bird in the clay pot, it soaks, and then you put it high heat and it gets it done so well. I have never tried it with like a turkey breast, but what does your guests think about that?
I think I've never like done that. I've never played with that, but I think it sounds really interesting. I think for me, I like the heat of the oven, and I think my oven's pretty small anyway, so it kind of produces like a nice environment for something like a turkey breast. So I usually just stick to roasting and I keep things simple, but I think that's really cool that you discovered that and it sounds really delicious.
Sounds good, Linda. Thanks a lot for the call at 800-642-1234. Eric Kim is with us from the New York Times food section, looking at easier ways to make our Thanksgiving meal less labor, at least on the day of, so we could spend more time with the people we invited over. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Gene is with us now, calling from Ashland. Gene, hi.
Hello. My story is when our grown children were young adults and they brought home their mates and our new spouses for Thanksgiving. Our dining room table is over 100 years old. And just as I was going to put the turkey on, the table fell apart. So the whole middle came down. So the men got under with hammer and nails and screws and nuts and bolts and put it back together, and then we ate dinner.
No, wait. Was there any food fallout? Was there food on the part that collapsed?
It slid. But we caught it all. And then, and I still have the table. We had it rebuilt, and it's still in the dining room.
All right. And it's held up for every meal since?
It has, because it's been rebuilt.
Excellent. Gene, thanks so much. I'm glad you're able to salvage Thanksgiving that way. Eric, have you had any holiday cooking fiascos? I mentioned, the oven on fire scenario with the turkey.
Yeah, which ones have I not had? but yeah, the one year I did cause a fire in my building and everyone was evacuated and I kind of ruined it. Everyone's Thanksgiving. I felt so bad. But I would say I got to a place where just Thanksgiving was really foolproof for me. That sounds like I'm bragging. I just mean that I keep it simple every
Excellent.
Year because this is my job. So yeah.
Thanks a lot for sharing that story. I love it. So, Eric, we've got your turkey breast recipe, your stuffing recipe, the cheesy pizza stuffing. We started talking about dessert, though, because you were making Thanksgiving when you were a kid. What kind of desserts do you turn to now for Thanksgiving or other big holidays?
Yeah, for Thanksgiving, banana pudding, I'm from the South, and that was a big dish at our Thanksgiving table. So I kind of took that and turned it into a caramel apple pudding. So in place of the bananas, I do this lovely like caramel apple apple mix, and I layer that with some salted cinnamon whipped cream, some vanilla wafers. You could do ginger snaps, whatever cookie you like. And as those layers sit in the fridge overnight, they like turn into a cake, like an icebox cake almost. And I just love that texture and that lightness right after a heavy meal. But I definitely still need a pie. I'm going to make like a cranberry curd pie this year, probably. David Tanis on NYT Cooking has an amazing recipe that's so popular. It's like 5,000 five stars. So I just have to see what that's about. Yeah.
Now, Eric, I'm the proud owner of a freezer full of Long Island cheese pumpkin. So I'm going to make pie with some of it. Do you have any pumpkin pie thoughts? Because I honestly haven't made a lot of those in my life.
I love pumpkin pie. I think one thing that people don't know is that the Libby's can is actually squash. And so when you're making your pumpkin pie, like, you don't have to use real pumpkin. And in fact, that flavor is really muddied and it's not the right flavor that you're expecting. So my colleague Melissa Clark developed this perfect pumpkin pie recipe where she roasts butternut squash, and it's actually a butternut squash pie, but it's pumpkin pie. It's the pumpkin pie that we know and that we grew up with here in the States. So that's my thoughts on pumpkin pie, I'd say. Oh, also, you need whipped cream or vanilla ice cream, at least. I like both of those.
Okay. Homemade whipped cream, or do you like the spray can?
Oh, the spray can's great, but I like homemade whipped cream because I salt mine pretty ferociously. And it sounds weird, but it's super flavorful if you salt it just enough and some cinnamon in there. It's a really nice whipped cream. And sugar, of course. Yeah.
And what is, are you cooking for people this Thanksgiving, or are you going to somebody else's and not having to do any of the work?
I'm cooking with my partner, actually. We're just staying here in New York and having a chill time. I'm thinking of doing like a turkey thigh, you know? I love poultry thighs, so
me too.
I think I'm going to try something like that. I just want to try something else because in a food writer's life, you sort of do the Thanksgiving months in advance for coverage. And it's just, so usually the day of, you kind of relax a little bit.
I love it. Eric, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Bless.
That's Eric Kim, cooking writer for the New York Times food section, New York Times Cooking, and a columnist for the New York Times Magazine. He's the author of the forthcoming cookbook, Korean American Food That Tastes Like Home. We talked to them today about how to simplify our Thanksgiving dinners. We've got a couple of his recipes posted at WPR.org/Food Friday. You can check out the salt and pepper roast turkey breast, along with the cheesy pizza stuffing. Give them a test run if you'd like this weekend. Let us know how they turned out at the Ideas Network Facebook page. And while you're there, tell us your secret to a fun yet delicious and not hopefully too stressful Thanksgiving meal. Again, share your story on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show, from the pandemic to addictions and overdoses, the nation's public health system has faced big tests over the last couple of years. Check out a conversation between Kate Archer-Kent and Dr. Leanna Wen, author of the new book, Lifelines. That's Monday at 8 on the Ideas Network. Yesterday, I previewed this morning's long-running partial eclipse of the moon. Did you watch it? Did you take pictures? Let us know. Share your photos, if any. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. And if you're wondering, did I check it out? The answer is a little bit. I had made plans, but there I was. It was 12:30. I was still up reading, and I thought, just one more hour and I can give it a look. But I was really tired. My compromise plan, laid down on the couch, fell asleep for an hour. Got up at 1:30, headed out into the cold. I caught the early stage. I could see the moon getting shadowed out by the very planet I was standing on. Then I realized if I wanted to see the full experience with the weird color and whatnot, I was going to have to stay up for at least another hour. So I went to bed. There are cool pictures online, and you can share yours or your own lunar eclipse experience. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. This is a fairly well-rested Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. The first-time penalty for possessing up to 14 grams of marijuana in Wisconsin could be brought down to a $100 fine and no jail time. That's one of the objectives of a new bipartisan bill a pair of state lawmakers introduced this week. On the other hand, the measure would actually increase penalties in some communities. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Where do you stand on legalizing marijuana? Do you support medicinal but not recreational? Both? Neither? Why or why not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Laurel White is WPR's Capitol Bureau reporter. She covered a press conference earlier this week held by the bill's co-sponsors, Republican Representative Shea Sortwell from Two Rivers and Democratic Representative Sylvia Ortiz-Velez of Milwaukee. Laurel, welcome back to Central Time.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
There have been efforts to change marijuana laws over the years in Wisconsin. They haven't gone very far. Can you remind us before we look at this new proposal, what we've seen in the past?
So we've seen a lot of action on marijuana bills over the past several years and certainly before as well. But I think it's become sort of a different kind of conversation since Governor Tony Evers took office. He has included marijuana proposals in both of his state budgets. The first state budget that he released in 2019 had legalization of medical marijuana in Wisconsin. His most recent state budget included legalization of recreational marijuana in the state. So this is something that he has certainly, backed, but it hasn't been possible because of the Republican majorities in the state legislature. They haven't taken those up. We've seen, in the past, lawmakers under a Republican governor trying to push these bills from the Democratic side. For the most part, there have been some bipartisan medical marijuana bills as well, but just not enough support from the Republican side to get those through.
So here's this new proposal, a Republican and a Democrat getting together on this. It is not legalization exactly, not even decriminalization exactly. What would it do?
Basically, what it would do is create a statewide standard for what marijuana possession penalties are going to look like in Wisconsin for the most part. So right now, the state penalty is for possession, first-time possession. It's a misdemeanor, which comes with a jail sentence of up to 6 months, a penalty up to $1,000. There's obviously some discretion there in sentencing. The interesting part about state law where this is concerned, though, is that local communities are allowed, if they want to, establish their own penalties for possession up to a certain amount, up to about 28 grams of marijuana. And so some communities in Wisconsin, including Madison and Milwaukee, obviously the two biggest communities, have done that, and they have pretty low penalties. Madison actually doesn't pursue any penalties for possession if folks are over 18 years old and they have less than 28 grams. In Milwaukee County, the fine is just $1. This is also the case in the city of Eau Claire, for example. There's a $1 fine. So it really varies across the state. And under this proposal, there would be a new state standard where it would be a $100 civil forfeiture, similar to a speeding ticket, or a cap of a $250 civil forfeiture. So it kind of sets these parameters for communities that they say, you can still do this. You can still kind of set your own guidelines, your own penalties, but it has to be within this window. It does offer the potential for community service, at least 16 hours, not more than 40 hours, if they don't want to have that penalty. But obviously, when you're looking at a place like Madison that doesn't do anything, this would increase what's happening there, right? So definitely a little bit complicated, but an interesting dynamic.
Talking to Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter, about a bipartisan proposal for a change in fines and the laws regarding marijuana in Wisconsin. I want to give a listen to the Democratic co-sponsor, Representative Ortiz-Velez, talking earlier this week about another aspect of the bill.
What we should think about is whether or not we believe that small possession of marijuana really rises to a felonious act. It does not.
So, Laurel, felonies for marijuana. Now, first offenses, I don't think, are where do felonies enter the picture here?
So felonies enter the picture here when you have repeat offenses, possession offenses with marijuana. And what this proposal would do outside of that sort of standardization of the penalties that I talked about is it would take away those felony charges for repeat possession as long as the amount in the charge, in the repeat possession charge, is less than 28 grams. And supporters say this is really important because felony charges, as we know, are a serious thing for folks to have on their record. They put up barriers for things that you can do and can't do in the state. They make it harder for folks to get jobs, for folks to get housing. And so supporters say this change would be really beneficial to a lot of Wisconsinites.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Kevin is with us in Pembine. Kevin, hi.
Hello, yes. I just heard about this first thing this morning on the news. But what I hear, it's all great and everything. I think it's good. But really, it's very time for the state to consider legalization, because I told the gal on the phone, I don't know if you guys have any idea how much tax revenue is flowing out of the state of Wisconsin into Illinois and Michigan. And I'm a proud contributor to the tax base of Michigan myself personally. And it's time, you know. I mean, they're losing a lot of money.
Kevin, thanks for that call. And you referenced Laurel, Governor Evers proposing legalization as budget, and the budget counted on some of that revenue that Kevin's talking about.
It sure did, yeah. When he proposed recreational marijuana legalization in this last budget, he figured in quite a lot of revenue that would come from that. And that's another argument that proponents have made for quite a while, is that the revenue that it would bring in, and have noted that Wisconsin is kind of surrounded by states that have more lenient, you know, laws related to marijuana and legalization. You know, Illinois has recreational marijuana. Michigan, as mentioned, has recreational marijuana. Minnesota has medical. So that's definitely a big part of the conversation, but that argument just hasn't been compelling enough for the Republican-controlled legislature so far.
Thanks for that call. I want to give a listen now to the Republican co-author here, Republican Shay Sortwell, talk about this as a bipartisan effort.
I believe this bill that we have put together does our best to kind of pull together the best of both worlds, try to bring together all perspectives across the state to try to find some sort of middle ground where we can move forward.
Still early days for this legislation, Laurel. Does it seem like members of either or both parties are jumping forward and onto what we just heard described as middle ground there?
Well, we know so far there are about a dozen sponsors from, you know, combination of the two parties. It does have bipartisan support, obviously, already. It's going to be really interesting to see how far this moves in the process. Representative Sortwell said that he, quote, didn't get a no from Republican leadership about whether this was going to get a committee hearing and move forward through that sort of, you know, step-by-step legislative process. But his argument there, as we heard, is that, you know, they believe, sponsors believe, that this is a middle ground. It doesn't please everybody. It certainly doesn't legalize marijuana. But it doesn't, ramp up penalties in a huge way either. So it's not really on either side of the issue. They say this is a middle ground. Nobody wins, but hopefully it's a step forward for folks. So that's kind of where it's at right now.
We'll leave it there. Laurel, thanks again for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Rob.
Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter. We talked with her about a new bipartisan bill aimed at lowering penalties for possessing marijuana in most of Wisconsin. There are, as we heard, some communities that would actually see an increase in fines. Coming up, we'll talk with a congressional reporter about a pair of marijuana bills at the federal level and their prospects for getting passed. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about how marijuana, medicinal and recreational, is treated by the federal government? Do you want to see the states keep taking the lead? Do you want Wisconsin to do something? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We just heard about a bipartisan effort in Wisconsin to address marijuana policy. Now we'll look at efforts in the nation's capital to move the needle, though Democrats there may be getting in their own way, our next guest reports. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on marijuana legalization or decriminalization at the state or federal level. The number is 800-642-1234. Mike DeBonis covers Congress for The Washington Post. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
You've been following two bills, Mike, one fairly narrow, one bigger when it comes to marijuana before Congress. Can you compare and contrast? What are these two pieces of legislation looking like?
Sure. Like most things on Capitol Hill, you know, the bigger you go, sometimes the narrower the support gets. So on marijuana, there's a narrower bill that just has to do with the banking system. Basically, what it does is give legitimate businesses in states that have legalized cannabis in some way access to the banking system. It makes it basically tells banks that if you want to do business with legitimate businesses, where the federal government is not going to charge you, it's not going to investigate you, it's not going to levy administrative fines against you, you go ahead and do business with them. And that's a big issue for businesses who in states that are operating legally. Right now, a lot of them have to deal solely in cash. You know, it really is a cash-only business that leads to all sorts of security concerns, logistical concerns. It's become a big problem, and it's really been something that states want to see handled because they see it as a security issue, a law enforcement issue, and you know, they basically want to rationalize this system. And there's been legislation now for 8 years in Congress to basically do this. It hasn't gone anywhere for a variety of reasons. Now you have Democrats in charge of, you know, the White House, the House, the Senate. You know, they are generally not, you know, 99% of the members are in favor of legal, you know, some sort of marijuana decriminalization. There's great, almost universal support for the banking bill. But what you have is you have an effort by many of these members to do something much broader, something that includes actually decriminalizing marijuana, taking it off the schedule of controlled substances, making it something that's taxed federally, something that's regulated federally. And these latest Democratic proposals have, you know, racial justice provisions in them. They basically say that this tax money that's raised should go to the communities that were most affected by the drug war. That money should be funneled back into those communities. There should be programs to help minority entrepreneurs get into business. Obviously, though, those provisions are controversial. They are not. They don't have much support, if any, among Republicans, and that makes it hard to move forward with this legislation, particularly in the Senate, where you need, you know, 10 Republican votes under the filibuster to make progress. And so that's where things are right now. And Senator Chuck Schumer, the majority leader, has made the decision that he is not going to move a piecemeal bill like the Safe Banking Act. What he's going to do is try to get support for this broader bill, even though it's really unclear how that is going to happen, how there's a path to passage for that broader bill. So right now, things are stuck.
And you report that some supporters of a broader bill worry that if they do the smaller thing, the banking and marijuana-related bill, that that'll be all the progress and people will give up on wider efforts. Do I have that right?
Yeah, basically, it takes away the momentum for doing something more. You know, this is something that we've seen happen on any number of issues. You know, immigration comes to mind. There are people who do small things that or are ready to do small things on immigration, but there are a lot of members that don't want to do the small deal because they're afraid that takes away momentum for the big deal that brings in a lot of other different issues that they want to see resolved. And it's kind of a classic story, but it can be a frustrating one, particularly for businesses in states, you know, like, you know, Colorado, Oregon, you know, go down the list of states that have legal recreational marijuana at this point. You know, this is by some estimates an $18 billion a year business revenue-wise across the country for legal marijuana. And, you know, they basically have no access to the banking system. They have to deal in cash. They have to do all sorts of workarounds. And it causes just a lot of problems that could be pretty easily resolved through an actually very short piece of legislation.
We're talking about marijuana policy and Congress. Mike DeBonis is with us from the Washington Post, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want federal law to change to decriminalize marijuana? What about this smaller banking bill that makes it legal, easier for banks to get involved in the marijuana business and make loans to it in states unlike Wisconsin where it is legal? Let's bring on a caller now. Colette is with us in Sauk County. Colette, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Colette?
Well, I believe it should be legalized. A lot of Wisconsinites are driving to Illinois just to use to go and purchase their marijuana and then driving back to Wisconsin. So basically, we're giving our taxes away to Illinois. We could be getting them here. And also, a lot of people, they use it for pain. When they use it, they're relaxed, they're calm, rather than going to the bar, getting all hyped up and, you know, drunk. I just think that it should be legalized. I don't know why it hasn't yet.
Colette, thanks a lot for the call. Mike Colette bringing up the revenue argument, and it's also a patchwork issue. Are people in Congress talking about the weird situation that's created when it's legal in some states, so like Illinois and not in Michigan, but not in other states like Wisconsin?
Yeah, for sure. And that's sort of underlying this whole issue is that, you know, particularly for conservatives, you know, this argument that states should, you know, be able to do what, you know, sort of choose their own destiny on their laws and not have to worry about federal intervention is kind of driving some of the Republican support for this. That's where the common ground lies. And where you lose common ground is where you start talking about things like taxing and regulating, and then you get into how much should the taxes be. You know, the heavy hand of federal regulation obviously is rarely popular among conservative lawmakers. That's when things get more complicated. But when you frame it in terms of we're going to protect states who are trying to do what and follow their own destiny, do what they want, protect them from federal intervention, that's pretty powerful argument that can attract Republicans.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Mike DeBonis from The Washington Post. Let's go back to your calls now. Sean is with us from South Beloit, Illinois. Sean, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about from south of our border there?
Yeah, so I actually was originally from Wisconsin. I actually was, when I was younger, I was on the First Offenders Program when I was unfortunately caught for marijuana. And I successfully completed the program for that First Offenders Program. And now I actually live in South Beloit, Illinois, due to the fact that I can legally obtain marijuana for myself due to medical issues for myself. And I do think it would be great for Wisconsin to, you know, get on that realm where they're able to, just for younger people, older people, just to be able to not have to deal with either the fact of, you know, misdemeanor charges, felony charges for multiple offenses, but just for younger people, maybe not to deal with the First Offenders Program where they have to deal with like a year, worrying about other illegal charges that may happen, because I just know that was an extra stressor for me as a younger person just turning 18.
Sean, thanks a lot for sharing your story. Mike, Sean voting with his feet there. And public opinion, at least according to polling, has changed a lot on this issue. I think that's been pushing some states to legalize. Is Congress watching that changing opinion?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's been a huge shift and it's happened fairly fast. Pew did a poll earlier this year, a plurality of U.S. Adults now believe that recreational marijuana should be legalized. Almost as many, another chunk of the population believes it should be legalized for medicinal use. Together, that's 90% of the population that agrees that it should be legal in some manner. It's just a huge shift, and it's to a lot of people in Congress, it's unconscionable that there really has been no significant change to federal drug laws since really the height of the drug war in the 80s and 90s. They just have not changed at all. And there's been no effort to accommodate states that have decided at the state level to decriminalize or legalize cannabis.
Sean, thanks for the call. Time for one more caller. David is with us in Madison. David, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I'm a chronic pain patient, and I listened pretty intently to the fellow who was on a week ago talking about the opioid epidemic, all the problems with that. He doesn't even think that there are people who live with chronic pain. The guy hasn't got it. So maybe if marijuana would help me get off of my opioids that I've been prescribed to for over a decade, and I'm in my 70s, and I go to couple, three different pain groups, and nobody there can use marijuana for medical use or whatever, because we all end up at a moment's notice have to give a urine sample.
David, I'm sorry to hear about that chronic pain story. Is this something, Mike, people are bringing up, marijuana as an option for people like David, as opposed to our ongoing opioid crisis?
It is 100%. That you hear this a lot, that you know, and it's you hear it a lot, especially from Republicans who represent areas that have been really affected by the opioid crisis. We saw just this week a Republican congressman from North Carolina, Nancy Mace, introduce a decriminalization bill. It would take marijuana off the list of controlled substances. It would do some tax and regulation, smaller than what the Democrats want. But you know, she has pitched this in part, like I said, on the states' rights issue, that states should be able to do what they want. But there's a lot of sentiment among Republicans that the medicinal, you know, aspects of this are compelling, particularly when you see it as an alternative to opioids.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Mike DeBonis from The Washington Post, looking at marijuana policy. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, Kyle Rittenhouse was found not guilty on all charges related to killing two people in Kenosha. A legal expert explains the decision. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.